Communications Board and our sponsors, the BMO Financial Group, I'd like to welcome you to this forum we're calling the Vaccine Autism Controversy, a Science Journalism Case Study. But before I introduce our moderator tonight, I'd like to say a few brief words about the Canadian Journalism Foundation. The CJF is a not-for-profit organization whose goal is to facilitate and encourage excellence in journalism. Through events like this, of which there'll be eight this year, through JSource and ProjeJ, the English and French websites we operate in cooperation with the country's leading journalism schools, through the three-day executive education program for media managers we run with the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, and through our annual June gala at which we present Lifetime Achievement and Excellence in Journalism Awards, and in addition pay tribute to a Canadian. 2 years ago it was Morley Safer, last year was Mike Lazaridis, and this year it's Robert McNeil, who's made an extraordinary contribution to contemporary journalism. End of commercial. And on to tonight's forum. Our moderator is Jay Ingram, the co-host and producer of the Discovery Channel's Daily Planet, television's first daily science magazine program. Before joining Discovery in 1994, he was for 14 years the host of the CBC radio science program, Quirks and Quarks. And during that time, he earned two ACTRA awards, including one for best host. In 1993, he hosted the talk show, a CBC radio series about language, which won a Science and Society Journalism Award. In the 1990s, he wrote a weekly science column for the Toronto Star, and before that, he was a contributing editor to OWL magazine. In 2009, he was appointed as a member of the Order of Canada for a lifetime of renowned service in communications. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jay Ingram.
Thank you, John. Welcome, everybody. I think this is going to be a really interesting evening. Coming from daily TV, as I do, it was sort of amusing for me tonight to see my interview with Brian air between a story on a guy who's building his own hovercraft in his backyard and before a story about New Zealanders trying to set a world record racing a kite buggy across the sand. However, that's the beauty of science, isn't it? That it's full of variety. And as I say, it's going to be a very interesting evening. And here's some background. In 1998, The Lancet, which I'm sure most of you know is one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, published a study that linked autism to the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. The impact, of course, was, if not instantaneous, powerful. Confidence in the vaccine slumped, not just in that vaccine, but many. Vaccination levels declined. Measles cases, among others, started to climb. And slowly over the years after 1998, there were suspicions among scientists connected to this world and this study that perhaps it wasn't what it purported to be. But there was still a debate. And finally, in 2004, the London Sunday Times commissioned or asked Brian Deer to investigate. And we should all be grateful that he did. Coming to the present last year, that paper was fully retracted by The Lancet. Andrew Wakefield, the lead author, has been investigated by the General Medical Council, stripped of his medical license, thanks in great measure to our speaker tonight, Brian Deer, and his dogged pursuit of the truth. Last month, his three-part series detailing the MMR scandal was published in the British Medical Journal. Now, obviously, as either journalists or people interested in journalism, it raises all kinds of questions for us, which we will be dealing not only after hearing Brian speak, but with a question and answer and with some panel discussion. But I think I think the most pertinent quote comes from the editor of the British Medical Journal, Fiona Godley, who wrote, "It's taken the diligent skepticism of one man standing outside medicine and science to show that the paper was in fact an elaborate fraud." And we're all honored to have Brian Deer tonight to tell us the story. Please welcome him.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay, for your kind words. My presentation up there with a little code on it. Elaborate fraud. Here's the cover of the BMJ just last month, making it clear in the judgment of the editors who perpetrated this fraud, they say. There is no doubt it was Wakefield. Is it possible he was wrong but not dishonest? That he was so incompetent that he was unable to fairly describe the project or to report even one of the 12 children's cases accurately? The editors of the BMJ say no. And those 12 children are at the heart of this issue of a vaccine scare that has taken off around the world. There's my first piece on the subject in the Sunday Times in February 2004 with an inside spread. Here's a television promotion for a television program I made that year. And then 2 years ago, another page one and spread in Sunday Times. And they're all about this man, Andrew Wakefield. Here he is with somebody who I think is, she's a singer. I think she's a Dixie chick or a Chixie Dick. She must be a Dixie chick. I think a Chixie Dick is a South American transsexual. So there's Andrew Wakefield with a Dixie chick. Here he is again, and here he is again. Again, you can't really see him too clearly in that picture, and on it goes. He was actually in training between 1986 and 1988 here in Toronto at the Toronto General Hospital, just down the street here. Then he moved back to London and took a post at the Royal Free Hospital, which is a, at the time was a 1,000-bed general hospital in North London. He was fired from that job in 2001 after he refused to replicate the research, which I'm going to be discussing this evening, on the internet and such other places. He'll tell you, and his supporters will tell you, that his research has been replicated. It has never been replicated, even by himself. He refused to do it, and he refused to hand over samples of his materials for other medical centres to look at, and so he was fired from his job there. He then turned up in America, in Austin, Texas. They originally planned to go to Florida, but then they ended up in Austin, Texas, where the very vulnerable rich parents of children with developmental disorders funded him to continue his activities in this country. January of last year, 36 charges were found proven against him by the UK Medical Board called the General Medical Council, and that included 4 counts of dishonesty, including dishonesty in his research, dishonesty over money, and plain lying to doctors who'd asked him about where he got his money from and where he got his patients from. And his license to practice medicine was revoked. He was found to have been dishonest, unethical, and callous. Last February, his research was retracted, and he was fired from his job in Austin, Texas, and his medical license was revoked in May. He's now essentially a freelance charlatan, traveling the United States mostly, really, in my view, preying on the families of autistic children. This is the beginning of it all. 1996, 2 years before the paper which started all this off, he was hired by a lawyer at a rate of £150 an hour plus expenses to make a case against the MMR vaccine. He's essentially a hired gun, and one of the things I established in my reports was that his total fees were about $750,000. I don't know what the exchange rate with Canadian dollars, it's all a bit vague, but anyway, it was about 8 times his salary as a lecturer at the hospital. He was paid to create this case against the MMR vaccine, money which began long in advance and which was paid at an hourly rate, so he was incentivized to keep this scare, to get it up and running, and to keep it going for as long as possible, because on that basis he would be paid more and more money at hourly rates. But here was the assignment. This is the basis of what he was asked to do, and this is what you do in product liability, basically. Firstly, he was asked by the lawyer to find a time link between the vaccination and the onset of injury. It's a very straightforward thing you need to do. You need to show you received the vaccine, the child received the vaccine, and then within a certain time they went on to develop some kind of problem. So that's absolutely basic. Secondly, to find a fingerprint. What is it that makes a vaccinated child who's been injured by the vaccine different from any other child? What is it that you can use to identify such a child? Thirdly, he was asked to propose a mechanism by which this this event occurred. How was it that the vaccine was supposed to cause autism in these children? And that's just the fundamentals of product liability law. But straight away, looking at this stuff, the alarm bells start ringing, because he'd already proposed what it was he was going to find before he did the research. In June 1996, which was before any of these children were investigated, he said he was going to find a new syndrome of bowel and brain disease. This man was a gut surgeon, so he found a bowel and brain disease. Probably if the lawyer had gone to a dentist, they might have found dental caries and autism. Or if they'd gone to a chiropodist, perhaps the chiropodist would have proposed a mechanism by which injuries to the feet went on to cause autism. But the lawyer went to a gut surgeon and someone who was interested in inflammatory bowel disease. So he proposed a mechanism whereby the MMR vaccine was going to damage the gut that went on to damage the brain. And they put this proposal forward for funding by the government's Legal Aid Board, which is a body set up to fund people in litigation. And it produced this paper. This is the cover of the Lancet, February 28, 1998, reporting on 12 children who were supposed to have chronic enterocolitis. For those who don't know, that's inflammation of both the large and the small bowel, and regressive developmental disorder, which he described as regressive autism. And at a press conference, this was released at a press conference backed by a video news release, a 23-minute video news release, in which his employers presented the British public with all his claims set out in a video package, was that the MMR vaccine was culprit in all this, and that he called for a single measles vaccine and single rubella vaccine and mumps vaccine to be given to people. And he didn't say that before actually making this proposal, he registered a patent on his own single measles vaccine as part of a whole raft of commercial ventures which were going on in the background, through which he hoped to make very considerable sums of money. Up to £28 million a year was the figure estimated in documents which we published in the BMJ lately. It set off a storm of press coverage, things like this, which I shall be talking about at Ryerson tomorrow to the journalism students there. Big story when Tony Blair dodged the question of whether his child was vaccinated. And this is just a tiny fragment of the stories that appeared in the British media at the time. It was a huge story, and it led to MMR becoming the most intractable health alarm in the UK, and has now been exported to Canada, to the United States, to Australia, essentially to the English-speaking world. Here's what he delivered on. Here was the paper. It was called Ileal Lymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, which is swellings in the small intestine, non-specific colitis, inflammation of the large bowel, and pervasive developmental disorder in children, what Wakefield called regressive autism. And it set out a time link between the MMR and the first behavioural symptoms, as Wakefield called them, and it set out what Wakefield proposed to be a new syndrome. So, and another paper was submitted, which was rejected, which proposed a mechanism. So this paper delivered squarely on the assignment to find material to put forward in litigation. And when I talked to the lawyer, he was absolutely clear. He paid for this paper to be put into the Lancet, in his view. That's the view of the lawyer involved. The paper talked of the apparent precipitating event. Wakefield's people are now saying, after having spent years and years saying that this was the paper that showed that the MMR vaccine was responsible for autism, now they say the paper didn't say that at all. It made absolutely clear that it never suggested such a thing. But in fact, the paper talks about the MMR vaccine as the apparent precipitating event. Precipitating, of course, as we all know, means causal. The syndrome proposed had a sudden onset. The paper said that what it said was that 12 families had turned up at this North London hospital. In 8 cases, the parents had said it was the MMR doctor, and our child's autism came on within just 14 days of vaccination. The second thing that the paper made clear is that 9 of these children in this series were supposed to have what Wakefield called regressive autism, which is a kind of autism where a child appears to be developing quite normally and then begins to lose skills. They lose language and appear to be moving backwards. And this is known as regressive autism, although the distinction between that and classical autism is by no means clear, because very often parents don't recognize some of the early symptoms of autism. And then the paper said that 11 of these 12 children had what Wakefield called a new inflammatory bowel disease. Now, some people have said, in fact, there's a writer going around at the moment saying, oh, well, the whole thing was ridiculous. No one would take any notice. Why would anyone take any notice of a study with just 12 children? Surely it was ridiculous to do a study of 12 children. Well, that's wrong. That is plain wrong. If it were the case that 12 families had turned up, as it appeared to be the case, as part of the routine caseload of one hospital, and the parents said, or they came to a bowel clinic, and the parents said, well, our child was developing normally, and then within 2 weeks of vaccination, he or she started to show signs of regressive autism. Well, I mean, that could be the first snapshot of a hidden catastrophe. I mean, many medical breakthroughs have been reported on just one patient. Now, if these cases were turning up in London, they may well have been turning up at the Toronto General and every other hospital all over the world. And it just happened to be that Wakefield and his colleagues were the people with the wit to report it and bring it to public attention. So at face value, if this scenario was true, and that just these parents started turning up and saying these things, it would certainly be worthy of publishing in The Lancet and would certainly be worthy of media attention and interest and public debate. Absolutely no question about that, if it were true. But the first clue I got that it wasn't true was this 14 days business, because I'd actually seen it before. I saw it when I was working on a story at exactly the time this paper was published, where 14 days was proposed as being a temporal link between the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine and permanent brain damage. And that view was put forward in the 1970s and 1980s. It was a scare that began in the UK and was exported to the United States and led to various legislation here. It also turned up in various scientific papers. It turned up in adjudications in court cases. If something was within 2 weeks, they would say, well, this is potentially due to the vaccine. And if it was outside, not. So I'd seen it before. And I thought, well, 14 days, that's a very cute thing that parents would turn up and say such a thing. And all of the parents set up this very, very specific time frame, particularly when the DTP vaccine was a very different kind of vaccine. The suspect component was a whole cell, formalin-killed whole cell bacterium, which was very different from a live virus. So I thought it was very strange when I first saw the paper. And I thought, well, is it too good to be true? And I think it probably is true for me to be able to say that for the first time, a journalist was actually able to get round the back of anonymized data published in a medical journal. And that's what I was able to do and what I'm going to try and explain to you very briefly now. First thing I found when we were able to get information about these children was that the families, you won't be able to make a lot of sense of that, but essentially what it shows is that these families were not just parents turning up routinely at a hospital. They're all, in a sense, in it together. None of the children were from London. Two were from the same doctor's office 280 miles away. Two are brothers. Two went to another hospital clinic. And one had been flown in 5,000 miles from California, as if California hasn't got any hospitals where they can look at children's bowels or look at children's developmental disorders. They had to bring their kid 5,000 miles to London. And you can imagine with an autistic child how strange they would find that particular journey. Wakefield gets on the phones to parents. And now he's a lab researcher. He's not a clinician. Andrew Wakefield has never had a patient of his own in his entire life. An extraordinary fact. He was a lab researcher. And he was phoning the parents and he was phoning the local doctors to target and arrange for particular children to be brought into this hospital. These weren't children that were brought spontaneously for medical care. They'd been individually targeted and arranged with anti-vaccine groups and with the lawyer. And the lawyer himself was on the phone. And he was sending out mailings to his clients saying, if your child has suffered from any of these symptoms of bowel issues, it may be appropriate to recommend them to for them to see Dr. Wakefield. So the lawyer was bringing these children. And this was how the fraud was essentially pulled off in the first place, by selecting and arranging and marshalling and bringing together particular children with a particular constellation of symptoms. These were children who had developmental problems, mostly autism, but not all, as we'll see, who did have bowel issues. In fact, almost all of them had severe constipation. That was their bowel symptom. And they were children whose parents, either through connections with each other or through memberships of anti-vaccine groups, were committed to complaining about the MMR vaccine. So when they came to the hospital, they were bound to blame the MMR vaccine, because that was why they'd come to the hospital in the first place. Now, I've got a quiz question. I sometimes ask people this and see whether anybody's got the answer. See anybody here's got the answer. If it's the case, as what I'm saying is true, that these children were all brought to the hospital rather than spontaneously referred, and the parents had come to blame MMR, well, why only 8 out of 12? Why would 8 out of 12 make this connection? Why wouldn't all 12? Has anybody got an idea as to why all 12? Take the guy at the front here. Anybody? Yeah, too good to be true, yeah? I like that one. Any more? Okay. Well, they did. They did when they came to the hospital. In fact, it was 11 out of 12 when they came to the hospital said it was the MMR vaccine. One didn't. The one who didn't, Mrs. 10, 4 years later, she changed her mind. And she wrote to Dr. Wakefield saying, "I've just been visited at home by a lawyer, and I've looked at our family photographs, and I now realize that our child was, in fact, a victim of the MMR vaccine, and we got a full slate." But at the time, at the hospital, 11 out of the 12 families blamed the MMR vaccine at the hospital. Now, problems with that, too good to be true, a dead giveaway. You then have a paper, people would just look at it, if it was ever published at all, people would look at it and say, well, look, this is a collection of people who are complaining about the MMR vaccine. So it was a dead giveaway. Secondly, you've got a coincidence likely, because the range of times was up to 4 months. Parents were saying, oh, you know, maybe 3 months, maybe 4 months afterwards. And that wasn't going to help the lawsuit at all. I mean, if you wanted a clear time link for a lawsuit, you don't want people talking about 4 months. It's like, you know, if you were hit from behind in a car accident and you said, well, about 4 months later, I started to get severe pains in my back. No one would believe that you'd suffered from whiplash. So it wouldn't help. And it also would have really exposed, I was saying, that association, the fact that these were a martial group of people. So that was the picture at the hospital. So what would they do to solve that problem? Well, he'd take some out and bring it down to 8. So instead of reporting 11 blaming the vaccine, he reported 8 out of the vaccine, and bringing that down, taking out the ones where the parents gave longer time frames, it got the range down to 14 days, which of course is a very disturbing figure. 8 out of 12 actually sounds much more convincing, much more plausible than 11 or 12 out of 12. They found a time link, and they'd created this association by going from that to that. Just like that, a contrived association becomes a frightening evidence of a possible link between MMR and autism. Then another clue comes up. I found a version of the Lancet paper that was circulated in the hospital in the months before it was published. And in this, the figure wasn't 8 out of 12 or 11 out of 12, it was 9 out of 12. And here, in this particular paper, this version of the paper, the mean interval, the average, if you like, for between the exposure to the MMR vaccine and the first symptom is 14 days. Not the range, the median. With 8 out of 12, the range was 14 days. With 9 out of 12, the median was 14 days, and the range was between 1 and 56 days. So you've got this kind of intermediate figure. So this is what it was when the parents came to the hospital, where 11 out of the 12 blamed the vaccine. Here it is in the intermediate version, where 9 out of 12 blamed the vaccine. And here's the published paper with 8 out of 12 blaming the vaccine. And this is what happens between the draft version that was circulating the hospital and the final version, where you see that by dropping the outlier from going from 9 out of 12 to 8 out of 12, the mean becomes the range, just by removing one allegation from the cohort. When did the parents make this connection between the vaccine and autism? Well, in the case of child one, a record showed Mr. and Mrs. One's most recent concern is that the MMR vaccination may be responsible. That was a GP talking 2 years, writing 2 years after the child was vaccinated. Case of child two, the GP wrote nil obvious re-MMR story, indicating that this was 5 years after, indicating that in this case the parents hadn't made that connection at the time between the vaccine and autism. Child six, who was also the mother of child seven, the mother has only recently associated the change of behaviour with MMR, and that was a consultant writing 4 years after vaccination. Child eight, several months later, her mum said she had been looking at a video. Child 11, I showed this is the child whose parents came from California. I met the family, met the father, showed him the Lancet paper, showed him how his child was described, and he took one look at it and he said, that's not true. And what were the symptoms, these behavioural symptoms Wakefield was talking about, the first symptoms of regression? In the case of child one, the child was pale. Now, I mean, I am not a doctor, and I don't give medical advice, but I'm pretty sure that paleness is not a behavioural symptom. It's not a developmental disorder. It's not the indication that your child has autism. And in the interview between the doctor and the parent, the doctor then asked the parent, well, was your child feverish? And she said, well, he might have been, so possibly. Did your child have delirium? Well, I don't know. As if she would remember that her child was pale. This was 2.5 years after the child was vaccinated, and she wouldn't remember that the child had a delirium. But in any event, delirium is not a symptom of autism. Child two, diarrhea and vomiting. I don't think that's first sign of autism, although I'm not an expert. Child six, fever, cold and rash. Well, you know. Child eight, rash, febrile convulsions. Well, febrile convulsions are not not a developmental issue. And child 11, the American, he had a chest infection. I don't think a chest infection is the first signs of autism, but Dr. Wakefield used that kind of information to generate his 14-day temporal link. And then in terms of his inflammatory bowel disease, he claimed to find a new bowel disease in these children. And he said that 11 out of the 12 of them had non-specific colitis. Non-specific colitis, in fact, is a condition which is when a patient has inflammatory bowel disease, but generally the doctors haven't decided whether it's Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which are the two classic forms of inflammatory bowel disease. But in any event, it's normally associated with blood tests, which can be taken without doing any invasive investigation, blood tests showing raised inflammatory markers in those associated with failure to thrive sometimes and with bloody stools. And that's what he said 11 out of these 12 children was reported in the Lancet and caused great concern. And Wakefield continues to say that these children had this inflammatory bowel disease. We put the pathology reports out to peer review last year, and the peer reviewer looked at the pathology reports and said that overwhelmingly they did not have non-specific colitis, and this was peer reviewed for a piece I wrote in the BMJ last year. So the reports from the hospital labs, in fact, it's the red bit should be increased to 4, really, but so this was the report from the hospital lab as to whether the children had inflammatory bowel disease. And you see that in 8 cases, they said no. Then in the intermediate version, which I was talking about, you'll see the number without the bowel disease falling to 4. And then in the final paper, you see it falls to just 1. And again, you see this progression of the paper, the content of the paper, being sexed up to meet the target, which had been set down before any research had even been done. If we take the case of child 8, she was the only girl in the series, the rest were boys. The pathology service reported that all pieces of colonic tissue demonstrated minimal inflammatory changes, which is in fact a normal finding, and they correctly reported that there was no abnormality detected. There was a medical school record that reported mild increase in mononuclear cells and lamina propria. I won't bore you with the technicalities. That too is a normal finding, and the clinical notes recorded histology normal. And then in the draft version of the paper, the intermediate version of the paper, reported that this girl was endoscopically and histologically normal, but then Wakefield reported in the paper that the child had acute and chronic non-specific colitis. The definition of colitis is very clear. I mean, it's kind of a bit technical really for a night like this, but the diagnosis of colitis requires evidence of injury to the epithelium, to the surface lining, and not simply a mild increase in the amount of inflammatory cells. And there's old box loads of scientific papers published on that. And it's important to realize that a specific pattern of low-grade inflammatory cell infiltration of the mucosa is normal and should not be reported or interpreted as colitis. And that's the literature on the subject. It's precisely what Wakefield did. So if we bring it all together, what he was looking for was regressive autism plus bowel disease within days of MMR, and that gives him his jackpot. That gives him his new syndrome, which he was contracted by the lawyer to produce for litigation. And if we bring it all together, this is what was published in the Lancet paper. If you look at the left-hand column, you'll see the children with regressive autism. Then you'll see in the next column, the children with the bowel inflammation, non-specific colitis, and then within days of MMR. And if you see which ones, it's true for all of those three, you'll see that six, about half of these children, have that particular constellation of symptoms, apparently. And that's what was published in the Lancet. When you go to the medical records, and these are overwhelmingly not GP medical records, we're not relying on the local doctor medical records, these are records which Wakefield himself would have had access to, and which in some cases he prepared himself. This is the picture that you get. Not one of these children actually had that constellation of symptoms, the three things, the regressive autism, the inflammatory bowel disease, within days of MMR, having the first behavioral symptoms, not one. So he went from here to here, and this was how the vaccine scare was created at its heart. Firstly, by the bringing together of these families who would come to the hospital, pre-selected to make this allegation against the vaccine, then the alteration of the numbers making the complaint, and then the individual misrepresentation and misreporting of these children. If you take, for example, if you go to the case of, you look at regressive autism for child, well, go to child 12, for example, you'll see here this child is reported as having regressive autism, but in fact didn't. And the same is true for child 6 and child 7. These children didn't have regressive autism diagnoses when they came to the hospital or when they left. And you can see all across the constant changing of this to get Wakefield to where he wanted to be. What does he say about this? He denies absolutely everything. He denies that he ever said the children were normal before they had the MMR. He denies any misconduct. He said he never planned to develop a vaccine. That he listened to parents, although he's never had a patient of his own in his life, he claimed that he listened to parents, and some of these parents actually confirmed that, because some of the, not all, but some of the parents involved in this study are essentially his collaborators in this scam. He denied ever having a conflict of interest, earning £150 an hour if you get a lawsuit going, and earning nothing if you don't get a lawsuit going. Didn't see that as being a conflict of interest when he published his paper. He says he's the victim of dark forces. He says that I'm working for the pharmaceutical industry, that there's some great conspiracy out to destroy him, that governments and pediatricians and are all against him. And in fact, in a sort of kind of closing note on that, it's something that was been raised with me in the last couple of days since I've been here. What he's been saying, this is Andrew Wakefield's message. He has been saying, and he's been saying it now for many years, that there was a wicked, and is a wicked conspiracy by doctors and by health institutions, by journalists such as myself. There's a wicked conspiracy not only to deny that vaccines are causing injuries to children, but to cover it up. as if doctors in Canada and the United States, pediatricians, people who care about children, many of whom have given their lives to helping children with autism and other disorders, are somehow involved in a wicked conspiracy to conceal catastrophic injuries to children. That is his allegation. He's produced not the slightest evidence. No whistleblower has ever come forward to allege these things. No document has ever been produced to evidence such things. And yet that's what he says. And he uses it to inflame the attitudes of very, very vulnerable parents who've, some of them got children with developmental disorders who've been led to believe by him and by those who support him that it is their own fault for vaccinating their children, for not listening to him, that their child has autism. And that makes those parents desperately vulnerable, desperately open to being manipulated and exploited. And that's precisely what I say he's doing. And you can tell for yourself whether he's a person to be trusted. He says the notion that any researcher can cook such data in any fashion that can be slipped past the medical community for his personal benefit is patent nonsense. He's saying that scientific fraud is impossible. That's Andrew Wakefield in summary of how he did it. And I hope we have a good discussion now about the issues arising and particularly the journalistic questions, I think. Thank you.
Be a technological moment here. Well, we all put on microphones. So I'm going to introduce the panel, and the remainder of the evening is going to flow roughly like this. Panel's going to discuss with Brian some of the implications of his work, and then we will open it up to questions and answers. But the goal is that we finish by 8 o'clock, so that gives us about 45 minutes. So let me introduce the panel, starting on the far right. Penny Park is director of the Science Media Centre of Canada, who are in a sense co-host of this event. And the goal of the Science Media Centre, which is up and running now, is to provide journalists and especially reporters who are assigned to stories with medical and science content that they may not be familiar with, to give them backup so that they get a head start on such a story. There's a similar Science Media Centre in the UK and in Australia, and I think starting in Japan. And we have one in Canada. Penny is undoubtedly the best person I've worked, conflict of interest, I've worked with her on and off since the early 80s. And I think that she's the ideal person to direct that. Miriam Shookman, sitting next to Penny, is chair of the Research Ethics Board. We are talking about research ethics tonight. She's at Women's College Hospital here in Toronto. Brian, of course, just spoke. Matthew Stanbrook is next to me. He's University Health Network respirologist, head respirologist, and deputy editor of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. So obviously, this story is of great interest to him. And I'd like to start with getting some comments from both Miriam and Matthew. Maybe Miriam, you go first.
Sure, I want to start by perhaps for all of us congratulating Brian on what is just an amazing story of investigation. He's brought the world a story that we wouldn't have otherwise. And I think that is what's so striking about this, that despite the fact that a medical journal was involved, that a medical regulatory body was involved, that a university and medical school was involved in investigating, that despite that, it took your work, including access to information requests, and including meeting with the individuals who were in this study, to figure out what happened here. And I think that that is striking, and how do we get around that? We don't, you know, much as I want to applaud Brian for that, I don't want us to be in a situation where we need to rely on that sort of digging in order to figure out what happened when a study goes bad, when we've discovered that a study was fraudulent or that misconduct occurred in science or that bad science happened. What else could we have? We could have much more transparency, much more disclosure from all of the various parties that are involved, that were involved in this research, that are involved in general, i.e., from the scientific community, from the medical journals, from the regulatory bodies, and in particular, the sorts of transparency I'm talking about. So, for example, Brian dealt with a researcher who had a very clear conflict of interest. And conflict of interest has gotten a great deal of attention, especially with regard to the pharmaceutical industry. Researchers who are publishing work where it's not clear that they have some kind of tie that would bring that publication into question. And how do we find out about those things? Well, we should be able to find out. And now, just in the past 2 years or so, in the US, there is now a place you can go, websites you can go to, where you can see what any researcher has in terms of, and physician has in terms of the money they're receiving from the pharmaceutical industry. That's not happening in Canada. It's happened in the US partly through regulation and through changes in laws there. I would like us to have that. Why does that matter? Because, for example, when I'm a psychiatrist in my own field, when someone writes a review article, as one psychiatrist who was chair of an eminent department did, recommending a medication on which he himself holds the patent, we should know that sort of thing. Recommending medications where he receives upwards of $60,000 a year in stock options from a given company, we should know that sort of thing. We should have a place we can go to find out. The journal editors who publish those articles, this particular man was Charles Nemiroff, who was chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Emory University, but the journal editors who published that article didn't know. And when Nemiroff was asked by the New York Times why he didn't say he had all of these connections, he said, well, the journal policies didn't require me to do so. So all I'm saying is that the issues that Brian has uncovered, conflict of interest, entering patients who should never have been entered, saying that you did things that you didn't do, a university investigation that was not done adequately, but was held up by a journal as saying, well, the university investigated, there was not fraud, there was not misconduct. All of those things could be made available to the public. And personally, here in Canada, I think we have a problem because less is available to us, both as people writing on science and as people reading about science, than in other parts of the world. So I'll give you just two examples of that. One is if you look at what Health Canada makes available to us. In the US, when the FDA is considering a drug for approval, for example, and a great deal of data has been filed with them, that data goes online on the FDA website 48 hours before the FDA considers whether or not to approve that drug. If you are a scientist who knows something about that drug, or you are a person who is interested in that drug, you can go on that website and pull down the data that the FDA has received. You will never be able to pull down any of the data that Health Canada receives, neither before nor after they approve a drug. I'll give you another example, and that's the freedom of information requests. Brian, in what he wrote about, had mentioned several times the various freedom of information, access to information requests he had to make in order to give us the story that he gave us tonight. And here, the Information Commissioner of Canada reported in April of last year that Health Canada got a grade of D because of their delaying on freedom of information requests. The sort of things they looked at was how long it took to get the request file, the average time was 4.5 months, and how many requests got carried over from one year to the next. Clearly, we don't have the information we need to report about clinical research, medical science, drugs that are being considered here, at least not if we need to get the information from Health Canada, which is the regulatory authority in that area. The Access to Information Commissioner, reporting about her findings in April of last year, said, do we have right now a government that is instilling a culture of transparency? I haven't seen evidence of that yet. So my take-home message from what Brian has brought us tonight is how very important it still is for journalists to do this sort of digging, but how much better it would be for us if there was greater transparency and all of us had a little more access to the information.
Is there any pressure being exerted to turn that around in Canada right now?
There's interest.
Interest and pressure are
different. I don't think there is pressure. I don't think there is pressure. When I've spoken directly to Health Canada about why they can't, the sorts of things they can't make available are, for example, they stopped a study. They told me, they were fine with telling me that they had stopped the study because they had questions about the researcher and about his methods. They could not name the researcher. They could not tell me where the study was carried out. They could not tell me if they had gone to the university to say anything about the study. If the FDA does that, Jay, I can go up on their website and they will list the people whose studies they've stopped. And if they've written a letter to a researcher, it is there. You can find the letter they sent. So for example, there was a case at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario where a child was injured in a cancer study. And the FDA investigated and found that there had been wrongdoing. The letter that the FDA wrote the researcher is still available on the FDA website. Health Canada investigated subsequently. They have never made any report available. Similarly, Bloomberg reports looked at a case of research in Montreal. There was a exposure to tuberculosis. These were supposed to be healthy, normal volunteers. They went in to a setting in order to partake in a research study to earn some money. They got exposed to tuberculosis. Bloomberg reported it. Health Canada investigated it. We only know anything because Bloomberg reported it. Health Canada did not release their report. So there is pressure in the sense that people keep asking them, but I don't see any, right now, chance for change. I think it's gonna fall on journalists to do some of this.
There are obviously many questions that I think we'd all like to ask, and I'd encourage the panel to interject as well. But Matthew, let's hear what you have to say.
Well, I think this case raises so many interesting things to discuss and has many important things to say about the weaknesses in scientific research for all of its rigor and strength. There are some weaknesses there and ways that we could do things better. And I think having discussions like this may help us do so. First and foremost, it's important to know that research integrity problems are widespread, but instances like Wakefield's are very rare of outright fraud. We deal with, as journal editors, instances of where we investigate potential misconduct regularly. In the last 4 years since I've been at CMAJ, I've personally led two investigations of potential misconduct. One was over plagiarism, one was over not having had ethics approval to do a study. And other of my editorial colleagues do this. Plagiarism is probably the biggest thing we see. So those types of misconduct do happen, and we need strategies to deal with that better. While big time frauds where data is falsified or fabricated are rare, there are reasons why they're rare. People who do this invariably get caught. And there are a couple of reasons why they get caught. One is, it is virtually impossible to do any serious research with any meaningful impact to science or clinical medicine on your own. You just can't do that. Anything that's really going to have an impact on practice, you need collaborators, usually many collaborators. So one person has a very difficult time doing something that is absolutely made up. And so these people tend to get caught. And the second reason is the nature of science is it catches mistakes. And when mistakes look funny, it tends to catch the reasons for those mistakes and finds mistakes that are not really mistakes. The nature of science is to be conservative and skeptical and to immediately replicate something that doesn't make sense. And when you can't replicate it, difficult questions get answered. So there is this self-correcting mechanism that does prevent widespread fraud from taking place, despite motivating factors, which are many, the pressure to publish, the money that you can get for this, the career prestige. So there's a reason this isn't all over the place. And yet, we have an instance where we have multiple instances of fraud, and one, in this case, quite unprecedented in its consequences, where serious harm was done to the public health and even deaths. So while it's rare, we need to be able to have mechanisms in place to handle it, and we don't. I want to echo Miriam in congratulating Brian for the years of effort he put into for doing this, which is truly, truly amazing. But I also want to add that he should not have had to do this. There should be a system that was in place to have done this for him without a journalist needing to do this. There should be a place within the scientific system that allows for this type of investigation to occur easily and free from conflicts of interest. And the truth is, we don't have that. The process for investigating this sort of thing, allegations can arise at many levels. They can arise from a complaint being launched to an institution, to a research agency, or most often to a journal. In fact, I would guess that journal editors probably detect most of these instances in-house, either on their own or because a complaint is brought to us. And we do deal with a lot of this, and a lot of this doesn't get public, but we deal with it. But once it's detected, there has to be an investigation. And then if the investigation is positive, there have to be sanctions. There are some regulatory bodies that have the power to impose sanctions. The three big research agencies for science in Canada have the power to do that. Medical journals don't have the power to do that, other than to revoke a paper once due process has proven that it's fraudulent. But journals like The Lancet don't actually have the authority to punish. It's important to recognize that when you consider this story. But the investigation part, that's where the system falls apart, because that is left in just about every jurisdiction in the world to institutions. So you get a complaint, you're worried about the complaint. As a journal editor, I might do this. What do? You ask the author for clarification. You don't get a satisfactory answer, or you get an answer that seems prevaricating or implausible. You then have to go to the institution that employs this researcher, perhaps a prominent researcher, perhaps a researcher that's made this institution famous, that has enhanced the reputation of this institution, that has close connections with this individual, has a stake in this individual. And this institution then has to investigate this person honestly and determine if they've done something wrong and then disclose that. There's an obvious conflict of interest there. And often that does not happen satisfactorily and certainly not transparently. And that's the part that needs fixing if we're going to eliminate this, problems like this from occurring. The last thing I want to add before we go on is that as editors of major journals that have the potential to create impact simply by virtue of putting something in our pages, I mean, all research is not just research, it's research plus the brand of the journal. And that matters. When The Lancet publishes it in their paper, it says, we believe this is true and credible. And in this case, it wasn't. We have a responsibility to think through the consequences of that, especially the unintended consequences. And so we have to be cautious not only to scrutinize the science, but to think about the context and the consequences of publishing. And mainstream journalists who report on it, who reported on this and in some cases fueled the panic that led to the drop in vaccination in Britain, have the same responsibility and need to think equally broadly about the consequences of that message on a population at the time where issues are being raised. So I'll pause there and just say that this is an extremely important societal issue and one we need to pay much more attention to.
Well, at that last point, Penny, you would relate to, I'm sure, because for many journalists, waiting a week or two or a month or a couple of months so that the veracity of a publication could be established just doesn't work.
Absolutely, and the pressures on journalists now to turn things around in a time frame that is so rapid. And the journals actually push out their information. They want the media, the general media, to cover it. So they're sending out things under embargo, and they're saying, this is going to be published. Here's our top hits for this week. And the journalists are under the gun. They've got, they might have just covered something else that morning. They've got to push out three times the amount of material now than they had to 20 years ago. We have fewer science journalists, actually, as well, who are specialists, who know how to read science journals and scientific information. The Science Media Center.
But even if you can read the journal, that doesn't mean that what the journal is saying is true.
Well, that's right. And I wondered, actually, if Brian could say way back when, what was the impact of general reporters on this whole autism link, MMR autism link?
A lot of the early stuff was done by specialist medical reporters at some newspapers, but the big push for publicity for Wakefield was pushed by general feature writers, columnists, I think a celebrity chef, a rock critic. Just about everybody piled in and had something to say on it.
And you mentioned collaborators, the fact that it's difficult for fraud to go on when you have a lot of collaborators, but there were several collaborators on that original paper, weren't there?
Oh, sure, there were 13 authors, yeah. And the others all staunchly affirmed that they didn't know which child was which in the final paper and really couldn't speak to the data. They were supposed to be able to speak to the data. The rules say they should, but they couldn't. Wakefield wrote the paper himself.
And over time, did they disassociate themselves from it?
Eventually, they did. 6 years ago, or 7 years ago now, almost all of the other authors dissociated themselves from the paper's ultimate claims of a possible link between MMR and autism, yeah.
And did the medical community step up and try to answer these claims?
Well, there's a lot of armchair discussion about how other research couldn't verify the claims, and people saying, well, there was only 12 children, you can't draw any lessons from that, and general sort of chit chat. But there was no attempt to investigate the actual factual claims made in the paper at all.
I'd say they did a bit more than that. I mean, the way the medical community responds is in the pages of medical publications primarily. Mm-hmm. The response from the medical community in the pages of The Lancet was immediate. The medical and scientific community roundly criticized this and foresaw all of the consequences that frankly The Lancet editors, in retrospect, I'm sure, wish they had seen. And foresaw this. You saw within a month or two of this in the letters page, you can go find it saying, you know, we are very worried that this message got out. Think of the impact this is going to have on the general public on vaccination rates, which is exactly what it had. And within a few years, research studies were done and published that far, far better and stronger than this case series of 12 that completely rebutted the whole theory and left no doubt in the mind of the scientific community that there was anything to this. And to my knowledge, not a single public health agency in the world changed their recommendations to the public about MMR vaccine based on this. So the medical and scientific community did not buy into this at all. And that's what's somewhat unique about this story. Had this been on a different subject where there wasn't a public movement on it, science, I think, would have corrected itself and there wouldn't have been a crisis. But because Wakefield was able to use the public and use public fears and a public campaign to mount a widespread public scare, this took on a life of its own. But it wasn't the medical community that did that. It was the public that did that.
But it sure proves that once the genie's out of the bottle and it's being, the public momentum is on the public side, the momentum is on the public side rather than the medical side, it's much, much harder to control it. Now, the fact that I can't keep my microphone on doesn't prevent me from suggesting that if any of you have a question right now, we'd invite you to come to the microphone, which is located there centrally, and you may put a question. I just want to say one thing, though, before we get into the question and answer, and that is because this is a controversial subject, it's quite often the case in question and answer sessions with controversial subjects that people like to make personal statements,
That's not what this is. This is a forum for questions that will be answered by the panel. And so, without sounding unduly harsh, please just ask a question. If I think you're making a statement, I will ask you to ask a question. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm struggling with a balance that you're trying to strike, Dr. Stanbrook, about reporting the science accurately in journals and measuring the impact it might have on society. As Mr. Deere said, if his facts were correct, if this was the front wave of a true epidemic that MMR was causing autism, clearly it wasn't, that would your considerations of the potential impact on society prevent this advance notification from being published? On the other hand, we really don't want another Wakefield or another something. So I'm struggling between these two important societal gains. We want to know about damage that is being done that we're currently unaware of, and we don't want to stoke fears about false claims. And I'm concerned that in avoiding the one, avoiding the one on this side, what you're proposing about holding off on publication, that wasn't actually what you were proposing, but it's what you seemed to imply, if it's a current hot topic in general society, we may do a lot of damage by not publishing the first signs of a nascent issue. And I would like all commentators, all panelists to comment on that balance, if you could.
Thank you for your question. To clarify it, I didn't mean to suggest that journalists should hold off on publishing stories. You are there to publish stories. What is newsworthy?
Well, I meant more about like your own role as publishing.
Yes, and I'll speak to that. What I might say is to be a little cautious about the manner in which stories are portrayed. I mean, one need only look at some of the headlines that Brian showed to see examples of where perhaps journalists might have been a little more reserved in their language to describe it. I mean, MMR scare, deaths feared. I mean, that is not what the Lancet paper said. I doubt that that's what the Lancet press release said. And we as journal editors who put out these press releases and by all means want publicity for research studies that we publish because we think they're important. We have a duty to convey that intelligibly to journalists and help you with this process. But things should be reported with a little less emotion and a little more fact sometimes by the mainstream media. But I do think that it is primarily the responsibility of scientific editors to make those decisions about what gets put forward to you in the first place. And because we have the expertise to vet these things that you don't have, we really should take on the burden of that so that you get the right message in the first place and can report it honestly.
I think what I might like to do in response to that question is talk about, you know, this paper came out in 1998, correct? And there have been significant, substantial changes in medical journals since that time. One of the changes is that in many journals now you can go and look at the data online. So much as I was saying, you know, the FDA makes the data available. Journals, and especially the web-based journals, which have grown up so substantially in that time, can make data available so that the scientists writing in the letters can also go and look at, you know, what's there. Is this reliable? But in terms of your point, are we keeping things out of, I think that's what you're asking us, are we keeping things out of the journals that ought to be in there? You know, I think of Barry Marshall, the person who discovered that ulcers weren't due to stress, that they're due to an infection, which is a major discovery. And he had a great deal of trouble initially getting that work published. I think there is a balance, and I don't think we, you know, I mean, I think it's a tension. I guess more than a balance, it's a tension. And I think, you know, the journal editors, even if they do their best, they're going to get it wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, the best thing we have going for us is that there really is such a wealth of science journals now, and that people can go back to a mainstream, you know, a leading journal such as The Lancet after they've published in a few other places where they might be able to get in when the big influential people in the field are saying that's hogwash, that's not. So I think there's a process, but you're right, there's a tension. they're not always going to get it right.
The Barry Marshall example is instructive because it was a breakthrough, but even in the scientific community, it was not clear that it was a breakthrough at the time. It took a while to realize how important that was. That is true of most scientific breakthroughs that are truly revolutionary. It takes a while to recognize the importance of them. And what is often missed in reporting is the sense of a discovery is made and right away we know it's a landmark. That usually isn't the case. And it's important to know that as journalists reporting on it. If something sounds like it's a breakthrough and suddenly we've solved all the problems that we say we've solved, that's probably not true. That's not usually the way science works.
But then he went through, Barry Marshall had to go through such an incredible minefield of actually getting his papers published because he was an outlier, because he was a heretic. And to me, this situation really shows a real flaw in peer review. The business with Wakefield, it seems that got through way easier than Barry Marshall, who was knocking up against the establishment over and over and over again.
Yeah, I think the connection between Barry Marshall and Wakefield, apart from the fact they're both gastroenterologists, is in a sense that the medical establishment said about Barry Marshall, oh, it's absolutely impossible for bacteria to survive in the acidic environment of the gut. The sort of old gentleman's club took this view and poo-pooed it. With Wakefield, they said, oh, you shouldn't have published this, you know. It's going to upset the vaccination rates. And it's the same kind of old boys, medical establishment kind of attitude that we know best. Nobody with Wakefield ever thought to ask the question, well, is this a scam? Is he just pulling a scam? Because a gentleman wouldn't do that. Wakefield was from the same class as the people who dominated medicine at that time and still to some extent do. And I think that's the parallel, is that there's this kind of this medical establishment view, and it's within that view that both Barry Marshall was approached and also Wakefield was approached with the suggestion that with the impossibility to recognize that this thing could have been a scam. Because a gentleman wouldn't do that.
Until Petty spoke about 2 minutes ago, it was the first time I'd heard the two words peer review. I'm going to assume, because you didn't mention it, that there was no peer review on the Lancet article. Is that correct?
Oh, no, it was peer reviewed, yeah.
Did you question the peer reviewers as to what access, what data they had?
Well, peer reviewers just have the paper. They just get the paper and they read it and they go, oh, that's all right. Peer review is a test of plausibility. If you can get through peer review, if you can produce it in a plausible enough way. Peer reviewer for this one, he said that the senior author of the paper was a professor of gastroenterology. Anything that had his name on it, the peer reviewer said, I knew would be a very high quality, well written, and the data could be relied on. Old boys network.
So they didn't have access to his data?
Peer reviewers don't.
All right. Let me ask, and I'll make this the last part of the question.
I thought there were 6 peer reviewers for this paper, of them said to reject it.
That's just something that someone's gossip.
That's not true? Okay, I'm sorry, I thought that was something you said.
Catch the problem in a lot of cases if there was a rule among the medical journals that the peer reviewers would have access to the data that the PI or the researcher gives?
That's been proposed. It's not done except in unusual cases because for privacy reasons and for proprietary reasons, usually. Usually, it's correct what Brian said, the reviewers have the paper. But I must say that is how most research misconduct, I think, and certainly most error in research papers does get caught. Because those of us who are used to looking at research papers over and over know what to look for. You see a certain type of study, you know the types of things that can go wrong, and you know where to probe. And that's what we do as editors. And then we send these out to peer reviewers who are not just experts in a discipline, but are experts really, really specifically on the topic of the paper. And they give us advice as to when they smell a rat, or when this looks funny, or when this just doesn't make sense. And on that basis, we make decisions. Is it perfect? No way. Because the quality of peer review depends on who you can get and how well they can give a review. They may be experts, but they may not be good reviewers. They may not be good commentators on that. So, you know, it depends on the quality of the advice you get as a journal editor, what you put into that. But even in the Wakefield paper, you can see some striking instances of what could have been caught. I mean, there was when I first read this paper, there's a word that screams out on the front page, and it's the word consecutive. We recruited 12 consecutive patients. That, as an editor reading this kind of paper, is an automatic question that you would ask. And I'm sure it was not in the original version of the paper. Perhaps Brian can answer that because he's seen it, which you usually don't get the chance to see. I'm sure he was asked that in peer review and made to answer it. And it was an out-and-out lie. It was clearly a lie. And one of the things that nails him in this paper is being a fraudster. But that is the type of thing that we do catch. And even without seeing his original data, you know something's wrong. Had he answered that question differently, had he answered it truthfully, this would never have gotten into the Lancet. There is no way they could have put that in.
Was there anything else in that paper that would have struck you as an editor?
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that screams it with this design, I mean, I agree with the statement about case series of themselves sometimes being important. They are the lowest level of evidence there is, but sometimes they're really important. The first description of AIDS, of SARS, these were all case series, and initially they're all the medical community has to report on a new disease. So they are important, but this particular design where they not only just presented the results, but they went back and ask the parents. Now, the parents are reporting on something that happened within days of the vaccine, but they're being asked about it years later. That automatically screams out about a problem called recall bias, where it's well known that if you ask somebody about something in the remote past and they have a vested interest to identify something, they will. To even put that forward as a design is something I can't imagine that you would want to go with as a journal. It's just such an obvious design flaw. So yes, there were things, and a good peer reviewer, a good editor, you would have thought would have caught that if, you know, other motivations hadn't perhaps superseded. So yes.
Yes.
Sorry, this is set up for giants. I'm interested in the journalism, and the particular issue that interests me is the question of tracking down the parents. I'm assuming that you must have done that through the lawsuits, but I'd like to hear exactly how. And here's the second issue on that. I'm trying to think of this in a Canadian context. In the unlikely event that the CMAJ ever screwed up and allowed in a piece that was a scam, and the even more unlikely event that a media outlet allowed a journalist to spend months and months researching this, our privacy laws would make this, I think, just about impossible. How did you manage to get around whatever the provisions are in Britain for ensuring patient confidentiality?
Well, there were two things. Firstly, Wakefield made the mistake of suing me and the television company and the newspaper and what have you. And in the course of that, the medical records were disclosed to me, although I made no use of them. indeed, and he ended up sending me a check as well. but I could make no use of that. But what I could glean was that it was important for me to attend a 217-day hearing of the UK General Medical Council, which went into these cases between, went into these cases and went over and over the children's medical records in my presence at a public hearing. And that's where all the data was laid out.
Hi. So I appreciate the sentiment, at least from the medical journal editors, that journals have this commitment to science. And this question I have is motivated by a comment Brian made yesterday at the Globe and Mail, in which he said, you know, journals are still ultimately publication and have, I take from that, you know, a lot of pressures that publications have, including a battle for, authority and respect and fame in the field, so to speak. And as an editor, isn't there also that other challenge going on? So when you get this sort of, you know, sexy study come out, isn't there also this sort of pressure to publish because you are a publication like anything else, and those sorts of publications do increase your repute and image, and I don't really seem to get that perspective of a journal editor from you guys.
So is your question, you know, do journals, medical journals have a motivation to publish hot, sexy papers? Absolutely we do. Is it a competitive environment? Absolutely it is. It's just like any other form of medium, very much like any other form of medium. Is that a pressure that could threaten research integrity? Absolutely it is, and it's our professional responsibility to do that honestly, as it is journalists' professional responsibility to do that in any of their own forms of media.
As a journalist, we like sexy. We have to have sexy or we don't sell. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Wakefield has sexy with all the pretty little actresses who said, can't vaccinate my kid, they could get autism. How do we as journalists combat that to get the real message out to the public?
But is that our job? I mean, I'm not campaigning for anything in that respect. I mean, do you think that it's for journalists to see themselves in that role?
I think that we have a role in education. What we write educates the public at times. And unfortunately, in this world of journalism, the new world of journalism, we have less and less of specialized journalists because we can't afford them. So beat reporters, basically anyone who is writing anything, has a responsibility to the public what we write. And getting the message reversed in a case like Wakefield, do you believe it's important?
I don't campaign. I think, yes, I mean, we have to do our jobs the best we can and get our facts right and bring forward new stories that people want to read. But I just hesitate at this idea that somehow we have a public education message in health policy, which I personally find a bit difficult to deal with, because that is not where I see my role in this.
The Science Media Center of Canada is a new nonprofit that's been set up to help journalists cover science when it hits the headlines. So we actually strongly believe in putting together good evidence-based science with the journalists on a time frame the journalists need. And I also, there's us that you can call day and night when you've got a story that you're trying to cover. But the other thing, I believe that scientists themselves have to make themselves available and step up and talk. And I think it's all about being transparent. And the more that we can talk about these issues and have them being discussed in the newspapers and on radio, the better informed we will all be to make decisions about policy.
I just want to address the issue of the patients and the confidentiality and privacy, because I think that really is an issue here. There are particular regulatory authorities who do have the right, if need be, to talk with the patients. So for example, in human subjects research, which this was, the Research Ethics Board at the given hospital or university that oversees that does have the right, if they have concerns, to actually speak with the participants in the research. Likewise, if it's a Health Canada regulated study and they have concerns, they have the right as a regulatory authority to come in and speak with participants in the research. So while the journalist can't, and usually doesn't have access to those records, there are people who can and whose responsibility it is to do so, and the journalist can go to those people. You know, there's questions raised about this study, or this study is in there, it claims that it was approved by your research ethics board. Did you really approve this? Do you know anything about this? Do you know what was done? Because that was done apparently with Wakefield study, and they did not know much of what had been done, and they did not approve much of what had been done. So again, that would reveal, all of a sudden you would realize something's wrong here. And that authority, that particular regulatory authority, has the responsibility to investigate. And so I do think journalists play a very important role, and whistleblowers who are not journalists play a very important role by bringing these things to, when there are responsible agencies who will investigate, bringing these things to an investigation point.
So we have two, looks like two questioners still and a couple of minutes, so go for it.
It's partly question, partly comment. I've been involved, I'm a pediatrician and have been involved in vaccine research for the past almost 50 years, and have dealt with a lot of the media, because I've been involved at advisory committee levels. And I'm just overjoyed to hear about the Science Media Center because it is so desperately needed. You know, I pity, you know, I've done lots of interviews, both TV, newspaper, magazine, and it's always very frustrating because you're usually dealing with someone who has no more knowledge about science than the general public does, which has negligible knowledge about science. And they're in a terribly weak position to write a clear article most of the time. So they need all the help. And usually the scientists aren't feeling that it's their job to help the journalist write the article. The journalist, I think, is, and I nobody's commented, but they, I think they're hampered by their basic assumption that there are two sides to every story. And that if the science says something, well, somebody else has another opinion, and we have to give them equal weight. This is true in science, it's true in biology, with the evolutionists having, getting equal weight with creationists, but it's an ongoing problem. I couldn't let this go and let the Lancet get off as easily as it is getting off tonight. I think they owe the English public an enormous, and the Irish public, the Scottish public, the Australian, the New Zealand, American, and Canada, an apology, because they published a terrible paper that never should have been published. Anybody, now the one thing, good thing they did do, and nobody's commented on it, in the same issue, they published a commentary on the Wakefield paper by the experts from the Centers of Disease Control, which pointed out all the weaknesses of the paper. He doesn't define what autism is. He doesn't define how he diagnosed it. He didn't. The parent said the child had autism, or the GP said they had autism. He accepted that. So there were many faults, but everybody forgot that commentary and rode with the exciting news about this thing. The Lancet should have learned its lesson because they were involved 20 years before with the pertussis story. And if you see the Kuhlenkampf paper, which you mentioned, it was exactly the same issue of case reports being falsely presented to show that pertussis vaccine caused brain damage. And the senior author, professor, pediatric neurologist, was horribly embarrassed when the cases were again reviewed, and he realized that he had signed off on this paper and didn't know anything about it. And, why did the same thing happen again? I think it reflects the relatively poor peer review process that the Lancet used.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, the question is really more information about the Science Media Center. How is it?
That's right, I'll talk to you.
She'll corner you at okay.
No, just in the sense of what's the science background? I can see the reporters accessing you, but where you're getting your scientific backup is a crucial issue, I think.
Yeah. Right. So we, just very briefly, we have a research advisory panel of about 22 scientists in a number of different areas. We sort of run the gamut from health to engineering and that sort of thing. And we have our own kind of peer review that we follow. So we've got our research advisory panel to keep us on the straight and narrow as far as the science is concerned. If we see a story that's come out and we go, looks a bit dodgy, we fire it off to people and say, what do you think? Is this something we should be tackling? So we try to do that, and on the editorial side, we have a group of journalism professors and journalists, science journalists, to make sure we're on the okay there.
And who funds you?
Well, that's a really good question, and everybody we can possibly get money from, because it is a free service. But I'll tell you more about it after.
We'll be passing the hat. And I guess this will be our last question.
Thank you. I hope there's. I'm a writer for a children's health website, so I've been quite fascinated by this story for many years. And one of the criticisms that I've seen about how it played out in the media, it goes back to this issue of balance and false equivalence. And I wondered if the panel, if we have time, could just speak briefly about that issue of when is it appropriate to give equal weight to both sides, and when should you be more forceful in saying, no, you're wrong.
Actually, I think that that issue is overblown. It's often raised in connection with climate change debates. And, you know, I know a number of journalists who think about and write about climate change who feel no pressure to give the other side when it's pretty clear that there isn't a substantial other side to give. And I think the same evolution creation was mentioned a few minutes ago. I think the same held there, that people who were writing about evolution really didn't feel it was incumbent on them to also write another, you know, three paragraphs about creation. And it comes down to the judgment, the expertise and the judgment of the journalist, that if, whereas, you know, in a case, many other cases where there's a hot debate about a topic, you know, maybe how the dinosaurs died out isn't such a hot debate, but was it volcanoes or was it an asteroid? And you can have a back and forth on that, and you can look at data and try and convince yourself. But I think it's mostly scientists who claim that journalists always are looking for the other side. But that's only a journalist's opinion.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, sure, okay. First and last, ashes to ashes.
So this is a question about science journalism. So if the three journalists here, I'd appreciate your thoughts. I read a story on CBC website last week about the Calgary's decision to remove fluoridation from the drinking water. Regardless of the science involved with this, this particular article spoke to a medical doctor, a general family physician, who said this was a great decision, because the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and the Ontario Dental Association all highlighted the risks and not the benefits, and that was their recommendation. They spoke to an oral hygiene researcher who claimed that this was a terrible decision. This would have a very negative impact on the health of Calgarians, because the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, and the Canadian Dental Association, so two out of the three organizations were the same, all recommended that fluoridation was a very good thing. Nowhere in the article did the journalist, and I don't recall who it was, did the journalist actually differentiate between these conflicting claims. So as a lay reader, I would have to go to perhaps their websites or do my own research, but I had no greater information about what the scientific consensus was based on reading this article. And I was hoping that I could get some commentary on your thoughts on the role of the journalist in communicating the scientific consensus. I'm assuming that the journalist did accurately portray the statements from these two individuals.
I don't know, I think the first goal is not to be confusing. So that might lead you in it, but I didn't see the piece, so I really wouldn't want to comment further than that. Penny?
Well, I would say the same thing. If you're confused, I would send a note.
It was very clear that, you know, one guy said it was the right choice, or the woman said it was the right choice, the guy said it was the right choice to remove fluoridation. The woman said it was the wrong choice to remove fluoridation. I wasn't confused about that, but there were diametrically opposed claims within their statements. One says the CDC and WHO recommends removing fluoridation or not fluoridating it in the first place. The other person claimed that the CDC and the WHO recommends that drinking water should be fluoridated. That conflict, that direct contradiction in each person's claims of what this other organization recommended was never addressed. So it wasn't a confusion, it was a frustration that there was a contradiction that was not in any way resolved. Is it the journalist's responsibility to accurately portray what a person on either side of the argument states, or is there an additional responsibility for a journalist to actually ensure that the person is that somebody is accurately reflecting the views of the CDC and the WHO? That's my question. I am neither a journalist.
I'm always
nor
very
scientist.
Reluctant to jump to conclusions. You just never know what happened. I mean, there may be some desk editor that didn't think it was such a big deal and slashed big chunks out of it. I mean, as a writer, I mean, I realize that often you have to get this into this, and it's very difficult to decode what is actually published as what was going on in the background.
That's why you put everything important right at the top, and they start cutting from the bottom.
I wish.
Thank you, everybody, for your attention and your questions, and I think we should all show our appreciation for a very talented panel. Thank you.
Let me add my thanks to that. In the coming days, we'll be confirming our April and May forums. We're working on a forum featuring Suzanne Legault, Canada's Information Commissioner, who will talk about how freedom of information works and doesn't work in this country. Plans are in the works as well for a forum on new media startups, at which we'll gather together some of the pioneers who are leading the way in developing these new forms of journalism. You can find out more about these forums by visiting the CJF website. Thanks for being here tonight. And now please join us upstairs for some refreshment, some food, and more talk about journalism. Thank you. Well done, Jay.